Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lauffel, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and today we have a guest whose name you probably recognize. Now, whether you know him or don't, you know, that may be so or not so, but you certainly know his name because you've read his articles. I mean, you might have seen him on Fox News 20 years ago. He was at Defense News. He's been all over. And of course, I'm talking about Chris Osborne. National Interest. That's where I think I first started reading your stuff, Chris, was at National Interest. And he runs Warrior Maven now. So if you are familiar with Warrior Maven, it's really one of the great online publications. If you want to know what's sort of the contemporary events going on in the Department of Defense today, that's Warrior Maven. And Chris is also the president of the Center for Military Modernization. Chris, welcome to NucleCast.
Well, I'm humbled and honored by your pleasant and very supportive introduction. Thank you. It's an honor to be here. I'm certainly familiar with Ottawa and your expertise.
So you write, you know, at Warrior Maven, you write and your other writers publish a ton of articles sort of on what's going on. What are the major trends in defense developments, in the systems we're building? What are the Russians and the Chinese doing and how are we responding to them? So based upon, you know, that sort of body of work, how do you look at the world and look at our adversaries and what do you see as sort of the threats that we're facing and sort of our strengths and weaknesses and then our opportunities to counter those threats?
Yeah, that's such an important question. And thanks for asking that. And it makes me think as you were citing the different areas, kind of a truncated or kind of a tripartite approach, largely China. And then the center is kind of what the U.S. nuclear posture is moving forward in terms of its strategic defense posture. And what comes to mind is the discussion about low yield. I mean, that's very current right now in terms of at what point will the low yield be fully integrated? The Trident 2D5 low yield was engineered and deployed a couple of years ago. And then, of course, now you have the SLCM, the submarine launch cruise missile, which is nuclear. That's kind of been resurrected. So I recall a fascinating discussion on the Hill years ago with Mattis and with members of Congress talking about this question of low yield and will it lower the threshold to nuclear war? Will it increase the dangers? Will it somehow make things more precarious? And if I recall, then Secretary Mattis was really had a powerful argument. He said, look, we need to bring Russia back to the negotiating table after the INF collapse. We need to give commanders more a wider umbrella of options when it comes to deterrence. We need options. We're not asking or thinking low yield for the purpose of a first strike or for in any way being responsible or being irresponsible with the nuclear weapons, but rather for deterrence purposes and the overall deterrence structure. So I would say low yield is huge with the U.S. And then obviously we can talk Russia, China forever as well. And of course, the ICBM, the Sentinel. I've talked to some of the guys that build the Sentinel and it has a great cyber component to it. It's very, very high tech. Now I understand there's using digital engineering, which we can talk about. Digital engineering is huge. You can use that. They're using that to realign and re-examine some of the models to potentially architect something new. So without going on, there's all kinds of important stuff, it seems to me.
So you mentioned digital engineering, and this is something we really haven't talked much about on NucleCast. Much of the discussion in terms of Sentinel is, you know, the delays and the cost overruns. We don't really talk about some of the more innovative things that are happening with Sentinel. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean when you say digital engineering and sort of what is it and where are we going with it?
That's such an important question. And it's really kind of reshaping defense acquisition and weapons development to a large extent. I recall being at a group meeting with then acquisition executive William Roper, and he was talking specifically about this. This was earlier in the day with the development of Sentinel. And what digital engineering does, computer simulations have evolved to such a point where they can very precisely replicate performance parameters, weapon specs, potential scenarios. They can replicate tactical scenarios as well. So what they were able to do in the case of the, at the time, GBSD, before it even became the Sentinel, they were able to look at 9 different models before they decided which ones to build. So the whole catchphrase is, before you bend metal, you can actually get a real sense of which designs are going to work, how things should be put together, and how it might function in an operational environment. I was shocked. I was a little surprised when I first started studying it. And sure enough, engineers say there are very reliable ways to do that. And so what I read recently was that Northrop is looking at new digital engineering applications to fast-track ways to improve it, enhance it, further modernize the weapon itself, of course. And there are a couple of things about both the history of the GBSD and where the Sentinel was and where it's going now. When I did an interview, I think it was at AFA a few years back, with some of the Northrop guys about the Sentinel, they talked a lot. It was before some of the first test shots. And one of the, they were very optimistic about the cyber sophistication of the weapon system. Not a lot of detail, of course, because it's nuclear weapons, but they talked about cyber hardening and being able to do that in terms of trajectory, flight course, and of course, preventing against hacking, being more resilient is a word people love to use when it comes to cybersecurity. So I would say there was a lot of optimism about the promise of some of the technology as of a couple of years ago. And like you said, the buzz has really been cost. But if you look at technologies and performance, there's a lot of success story there.
So on December 4th, ANWA had an event in which General Armagost, the current 8th Air Force commander, was the guest. And, you know, he talked a bit, and then people were able to ask questions. And for those that didn't see it, it's available on the ANWA website. But one of the things that we didn't talk to General Armagost, because, you know, he owns the bomber leg, is this idea of sort of the infrastructure challenges that are present with, you know, with Sentinel. But you can also talk about this because, you know, the B-21 is going to have infrastructure requirements as well. You'll have to have changes at Dyess and Ellsworth. And so can you talk a little bit about sort of both the Sentinel infrastructure challenges, which seem to be the long pole in the tent for the delays and overruns for Sentinel? Sort of what is the challenge that they're facing? Why is this a challenge? And then is there anything that NucleCast listeners might need to know in terms of, you know, infrastructure as it relates to B-21?
Sure. And they're too, they're of course interrelated, which is a great reason to bring up both of them at once. And the whole idea of commanding control and networking nodes, there's some higher frequency or different radio technologies that can be used to enable essentially even presidential connection with an in-air nuclear armed bomber. As for your other question, that's excellent. I would say digital engineering is a big part of this because they can look at specs. And I don't, from what I understand, and you, I'm sure, know way better than I on this, there weren't a whole lot of technical problems in terms of its performance. It was more cost and delays rather than the technology itself. That being said, it doesn't mean there can't be adjustments, tweaks, and adaptations that improve the weapon as it moves forward. And it reminds me, it does make me think of the B-21, because the big thing I recall learning about that was that it's not just a bomber, but it's a sensor, right? There's so much more than just carrying weapons, that there's this sort of combat cloud. There's this integrated mesh, this web network of connectivity that the Pentagon is moving toward very quickly and making a lot of progress with. So we could talk about JADC2, but with the Sentinel, I think the technology and the design, just based on what little I read and discussed and wrote about this previously, shows a lot of promise. And I'd love to know, if there were some technical hurdles, what some of those were. Because what I understand was that the cyber development was really promising, and they were looking at some of the boosters, some of the motors, and that it was showing promise. But that was a few years ago. So I'm sure it sounds like they did run into some developmental glitches, which is why digital engineering would make a heck of a lot of sense, because that's a way you could address it without necessarily having to scrap the entire design.
Now, you bring up, you mentioned some of the cyber issues, and this is sort of one of the big, you know, big challenges right now up for the NEC up at Stratcom, and that is as we move from an analog NC3 system in many respects to a fully digital NC3 system, and then you have cyber concerns. You know, how do you maintain security, and how do you ensure nobody gets inside your networks? Nobody can mess with your data, your information, because you have to maintain trust of your information. So as you've written across this area, and it goes, you know, the same is true with JADC2, because in join all domain command and control, you're going to be sharing command and control across conventional and nuclear platforms. So how is DoD and the defense industry talking about maintaining that security and ensuring that our systems are secure?
That's such a great question. Remember when the Pentagon went to Windows 10? I remember Halvorsen, yep, the CEO at the time, talked about how even commercial kinds of technology can download the latest patches and you can still, to an extent, maintain and even improve your security. But that's kind of been the trillion-dollar question, right? When you move to more costs, when you accelerate the developmental pace, do you compromise security in any way? And how can you reconcile this seemingly paradoxical situation? You want greater connectivity, you want greater interoperability, but as weapon systems become more computer reliant, they become better. But then, of course, do they become more vulnerable as well? How do you address that? One of the things I've written about a little bit is virtualization of software and the need to move beyond perimeter security. And when you move to cloud, things like cloud advantages are beyond description in terms of points of entry and information sharing. It's incredibly powerful. At the same time, it also does present a challenge in terms of hardening that system. So I recall Bush's General Palikowski, brilliant Air Force leader years ago, talked about a 7-point cyber plan at the Air Force, and she talked about baking in cyber resiliency. So one of the key things that the Air Force and the other services are doing is looking at vulnerabilities in the infrastructure technically earlier on in the developmental process of a weapon system to try and identify vulnerabilities, address them, solve them, patch them before you get to those next phases. The Army's doing that too. Army Research Lab, they were red teaming technologies as well as earlier weapons developers early on in the process to find those weak points, to solve them and better prepare them for the next phase so that you have something hardened before it all gets to an operational situation and can then be penetrated. So that's a key question. Gosh, we could do this. Is really, you could say the security of the world hinges to a degree on reliable information and further securing interoperability through some of these technical areas.
Now, China, you've got an article at Warrior Maven that's up today that talks a bit about how the Chinese are looking at, you know, our efforts to, you know, build these, you know, JADC2-ized world and, you know, all of this interoperability and all of the cyber interconnectivity. And the Chinese want to both have their own capability and they want to, you know, disrupt ours. Can you talk about that a bit? And what are the Chinese doing in a number of these areas? And how are they trying to both thwart what we're doing and thwart our efforts, you know, like in a defense of Taiwan, for example? What are they up to?
That's such an important question. And gosh, we could discuss this at great length. And it's hard to think of something more important. I remember interviewing some of the initial members of the Congressional Committee, this Select Committee on China, which was working specifically at some of the threat equations. Even you go back 10 years and the congressional report, the Economic and Security Review on China, sure enough, talked about cyber weapon theft and cyber intrusions years ago in terms of weapon specs. So I mention that because there's the well-known issue of technologies being stolen and copied. One of the things that I started noticing looking at all the Chinese papers and writing about the weapon systems that in terms of just what they say about them is there was not just an effort to replicate the technology, but there was an effort to steal the doctrinal approaches, steal the tactics, steal the concepts of operation. Sure enough, they had articles about multi-domain task force kinds of operations, tests and experiments. And then lately, as you point out, this intelligence-ized warfare is what it is technically, but it's also conceptually and operationally a total JADC2 ripoff. And so there's been maybe a kind of casual way to say it, but there are parallels there that probably aren't coincidental is what I mean.
Yeah. Now we're at that time in the show where we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, if you could delve into your take on the Ukraine conflict, and then also how do you think from what you've, you know, as you interview and as you meet with folks with the incoming Trump administration, how do you think they're going to look at the Ukraine conflict? So you're listening to NucleCast and we're talking to Chris Osborne, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the Ann Law Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, Chris. I posed a question before the break. You know, what's your take on Ukraine and what you think the Trump administration might do?
Interesting. You know, we've heard discussion about how the Ukraine conflict might come to a faster end once the new administration comes to power. I don't really know, but what we are seeing as far as what's happening on the ground, you could almost call it an escalation right now in terms of the longer range missiles and then, of course, the nuclear threats. Are the tensions escalating? And what does that mean? Because here we are barely a month and plus a few weeks beyond when President Trump will take over. So I think it's a really fascinating opening open question to a degree, because how much ground can be held? I wouldn't be surprised if there was some sort of reconciliation where the boundaries arrive at a certain space. I don't know if it's Crimea, Kursk is included or not, but you come up with a certain boundary with the assurance that they won't join NATO. But then again, they want to join NATO. So I just think it's complicated. I think it's very, very complicated. And then also you have the resolve of the Ukrainian fighters. They took the world by storm with their javelins and anti-tank weaponry, doing those crossroad attacks, hit-and-run ambushes, knocking out tanks, knocking out armored convoys. They have a will to fight that's incredible, just based on reading it and observing it and writing about what the developments are over there, kind of a David and Goliath situation. I remember an expert at the beginning of the war said, Russia not only has the second military in the world, but the second military in Ukraine. And so there was this incredible push, and the weapons are making a difference with that. I mean, the Ukrainians, we should talk about this. The armored vehicles, I think, is really the key in terms of maneuver formations and holding ground. But as far as what will happen next, I wonder. Trump has a way of getting things done. Maybe he'll find a way to finesse an end to the Ukraine war. That would be an impressive feat.
Yeah, some are saying that it's sort of reminiscent of the Iran hostage, you know, agreement that was, you know, it was brokered by the Carter administration, but it didn't occur until President Reagan took office. And so he sort of got credit for it. But there's sort of a discussion that something akin to that might be going on now. And I don't know whether that's true or not, but, you know, that's sort of the scuttlebutt. Do you think, as we look at lessons learned, and as you observe and pay attention to what we're learning and what, you know, the Russians, the Ukrainians, and others, are we learning the right lessons from Ukraine?
Gosh, man, I know I'm talking to one of the leading experts in the world, but I get questions like this. This is right on the money. I just came from a couple-day counter-UAS conference, which was all about looking at ways to identify drone swarms and counter them using enterprising technology. I would say at the moment, we're doing better. And I think the key lessons there are almost paradoxical, because on one hand, you have the recognition that certain traditional forms of combined arms still matter. Mass still matters. Artillery still matters. Rockets still matter, despite the evolution of AI-enabled networking and drones and ISR. There is a place for sort of more traditional combat and weaponry, thus the need to replenish the arsenal of 155s in perpetuity, at least as it looks right now. And then on the other side of that, you have the innovators, and you have this way in which drones and unmanned systems are being used with commercial applications that are getting noticed all across the place. I heard about that a lot these last couple of days. How are the Ukrainians countering what the Russians are doing in the air? Are they putting, in some cases, grenades on a UAS? Are they programming things in a certain way? How do you detect and pick up the protocol of an enemy drone in the air so as to disable it? I learned about that to a greater degree just the last couple of days. So drone defense is huge. There is an absolutely beyond describable push right now to find ways to improve drone defenses. And it reminds me of a recent discussion I had with a vice admiral. They call him Hack, Hackadoomzadeh. He was the commanding officer of the Carrier Strike Group 2 in the Red Sea. So he was kind of front and center with intercepting all of those Houthi missiles and drones. And one of the things he said you really need is a big enough magazine. We'll get to the day where non-kinetic options, things like lasers and EW, while already operational, can get even better. You can go after what he said, the archer, not just the arrows, right? But when it comes to intercepting the arrows and you're looking at drone swarm contingencies, you need a bigger magazine. That was kind of his point, whether it's deck-mounted guns, interceptors alone. They can maybe take out one or two, but can they take out a swarm? One of the big developments with that he talked about was air-to-air kills. Sure enough, they had an F-18, a Growler, an EW aircraft in the air, typically thought of in terms of just EW. Well, it also has air-to-air kinetic kill capability from the air, knocked out Houthi drones, and that makes a lot of sense if you start looking at the beyond the horizon radar aperture, the ISR, and the point at which you want to see something. But we also talked a fair amount about Aegis and the integrated ISR, because you can kind of see things from so many different angles, from space, from the surface, from drones, and so all simultaneously. So it gives you a really high fidelity picture. That's a word weapons developers love, right? Fidelity in your imaging, whether it's radar or things like that. But so I would say, those are just a couple thoughts. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, my question, though, is are we going to be, and this is something, you know, I think the Chinese are probably going to do to us in Taiwan, is that, you know, for every exquisite weapon system we have, you know, they have 10 that are less exquisite. And so, you know, when we shoot one $1 million missile at a, you know, $5,000 drone, you know, is that ultimately a victory for them? We may take the drone out, but we've spent $1 million to their 5,000. And just how long can we do that because of the challenges we have in replenishing that arsenal, you know, the magazine depth issue, especially when, you know, if you look at defense spending, you know, we're at the lowest, you know, relative percentage of GDP on defense spending that we've been in. I mean, I don't know. I think it's been the 19 prior to World War II. You know, we're at about 3.4% of GDP. And so my question, and there's a push to go lower. And this is, you know, one of the great things that I've not seen anywhere. I haven't seen it at, you know, at Warrior Maven, at National Interest, anywhere, is this broader discussion of the guns versus butter debate. And we've not had this fundamental discussion about, hey, you know, about 70%+ of our federal budget goes to domestic social programs of one form or another. And only about 15% is going to defense, which historically defense was the single largest component of the federal budget. And it's not even close anymore. It's number 4 or 5. And so, you know, how do we maintain our status in the world if we're so heavily focused on, you know, the redistribution of income through all sorts of mechanisms? And I just don't know that they both are not sustainable. And that's part of what's going to be interesting. And this is sort of my next question for you, as you're observing all that's going on in Washington, you know, and as a journalist focused on the defense sector. And you see there is a expectation of a new administration that's going to be radically different from the current administration. And people are even trying to start acting to sort of align to be less, I don't know if you want to say less offensive to the new administration, but less sort of out of sync with what that new administration's positions are. What are you observing as we get closer and, you know, from the time that, you know, the election took place to now, you know, we're 5-6 weeks out from inauguration? What are you seeing change, and how are you seeing people respond to, you know, the election and the you know, the return of President Trump?
That's a great point. And one of the things you think about is sort of the wave of change, because you think of all the people appointed by the administration are just starting to emerge and starting to rise. So I think we won't see the change for another several months to a degree, if not longer, when it comes to actual on-the-ground policy at certain levels, although we also may see a lot of change very, very quickly, right? That's how President Trump often likes to operate, get something done super fast. So I would say I don't hear a lot of it articulated or spelled out. You hear a lot of pride and nationalism, a lot of unity discussions, sort of helping to heal from the political tensions that have kind of bothered America would be an understatement for the last stretch here, and kind of thinking of unifying and thinking of an American premise, the idea of both conservative Democrats or even centrist Democrats and Republicans love the military. And that was kind of my thinking with starting the Center for Military Modernization, is to avoid the partisan and necessarily look at what's going on with how people on both sides of the aisle want to increase defense spending, believe in the importance of defense. And if you look at something like the committees and Virginia-class submarines, there's a lot of bipartisan cooperation. There really is. And so that's encouraging. And so that's important. You also made me think of something else, which was important. And I'm remembering that as I speak. And so maybe you can help me pick up here. But I think what I'm talking about is defense budgets. I recall talking to former Congressman Forbes, who is the subcommittee guy for projection forces. Great, smart American. We were talking about the size of the Navy fleet. And he made the point that sure enough, in the Reagan era, there were 500 ships. And so I followed the Navy size debate. How big do you need your Navy? What if you're technologically superior? And another interview I did more recently was Representative Whitman, and he says, you know, we know they've always had quantity, but they have quality now, talking about the Chinese, saying the threat is changing exponentially.
Yeah. Now, we're at that time in the show where I have to bring out Bob the Genie. So as I rub my magic lamp, Bob grants all guests 3 wishes. But they have to be, you know, related to the topics we've been discussing. You know, you can't wish, you know, for luscious locks back or, you know, great wealth or any of that kind of stuff. You got to make wishes related to our topics. So, Chris Osborne, what is your first wish?
Well, I remember, I'm trying to recall the name. I did a wonderful interview with an Air Force 3-star early on in the GBSD program. And one of the things he talked about was the need to spread 400 ICBMs across that wide expanse and parts of America. And he talked about the fundamental concept of deterrence. And he actually taught me something that now I recall. He talked about a philosopher in the 50s who talked about the irony or the paradox of nuclear development, which is, for the first time, arguably in history, a weapon's being developed to not be used. You think since the days of knives and pitchforks, they were with the intent of making sure you use them in combat. Well, the whole point of nuclear deterrence is the paradox, right? Promise of catastrophe for the purpose of keeping the peace. And he told me there was a Yale philosopher named Brody. Sure enough, in subsequent years, I've looked up some of his
Bernard Brody, yep.
Yeah, he's brilliant.
Yeah,
he's amazing. So I didn't answer your question about the wish. I would have to say I want to see a GBSD, an ICBM, resurrected, on track, in place, and ready for the future. Because I recall I showed up at a space and missile defense conference a few years ago, and former STRATCOM guy Chaz, I don't know if they call him that kind of casually, but Admiral Richard, talked about how commercial satellites were already seeing silos being built on the Chinese mainland in terms of a ground leg to a Chinese triad. And so he expressed great concern about that. And I've heard, you hear a little whisper sometimes about, could we get by with the dyad? And my thinking is absolutely no way. You have to have those ICBMs. So my first wish is that we get a robust, hardened, networkable, ready ICBM for the future, because the Minuteman is just gasping for breath at this point.
Oh, that's a good one. I like that. That's I agree with you, but I'm biased. So, okay. So that's wish number one. Now you can, you don't have to stick with the nuclear. We've sort of talked broadly, but what would your second wish be?
Well, if we're talking broadly, my second wish would be to find a way to flex the industrial base. And there was a study done by the Navy years ago when Gertz was the AE or acquisition executive that found the industrial base could accommodate that. And I'm talking about building Virginia class submarines and building Columbias. I think I showed up at Electric Boat and did some of the touring of the fantastic work that's going on there with the early phases of Columbia, as well as, of course, the need to build Block 5 and forward Virginias. And I would say the deficit in terms of just what commanders say publicly is that the submarine deficit is significant. As more Los Angeles retire faster than Virginia arrives, there's this gap in the submarine fleet that we're trying to fill. And that was the example of bipartisan cooperation I've thought of, because on some of the committees, Democrats and Republicans are saying, how can we build two a year? How can we build three a year? How can we build more Virginias on a faster time frame to address this deficit? If you look at something like the Pacific and the maritime environment, submarines, and this is just, you know, an observer saying, they could save Taiwan. You look at the undersea superiority and how important it is.
Yeah, that's another good one. You're sort of hitting the great wishes list. So, okay, now you got one final wish. So, you know, it's at your disposal.
I would say rapid arrival of B-21s. I mean, that's a promising program. I think from what I recall, and you would know better than I, that it's progressing pretty well in terms of production and testing. But I would say the need to replace the B-2 for in large measure, because I recall General Politkovsky, Air Force General, in an interview said stealth is one arrow in the quiver. We have to look at a number of different things. Why? The Russian media touts that its S-500s, its S-400s can digitally network, can look on a brighter, wider sphere of frequencies, can detect and destroy stealth aircraft. Now, is that true? Obviously, hyping their own weapon systems is not beyond the Russian media. So who knows? But there is a different threat to stealth, which is part of why the B-2 had upgrades like the defensive management system sensors that can tell you where defense air defenses are to go around them, essentially hardening things. So the B-2 is still a very credible, incredible machine. I wrote about its 30th anniversary. But the need for the arrival of the B-21, and I can speculate, but gosh, it's so dark, such a black program, who knows what its stealth properties are. But there is a lot of confidence with which senior leaders say it can hold any target at risk, anywhere in the world, anytime. And that's a big deal to me when you think of the air triad and you think of the need for something like the LRSO, which we didn't even get to. That's such a key weapon. I would say make sure all three legs of the triad are secure and massively supported. And yes, make sure you get as large a fleet of B-21s as fast as you can, because from what I recall, the staggered arrival of B-21s will influence the pace at which B-1s and B-2s can start retiring. So you want a large, they should get 200 of them. I think it's only 100 now. A couple of years ago, they were talking 200. So I want to see a big B-21 fleet. That's my final wish.
All right. Chris Osborne, thanks for, that was the three great wishes. I like them all. I'll make sure Bob the Genie does exactly that. But Chris Osborne, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
It's an honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode. If you've not read Warrior Maven, let me recommend going to warriormaven.com, because Chris Osborne writes a lot of great articles, and he's got some other folks that are, you know, he's got some retired general officers that write for him, and a lot of great material on, you know, military modernization and sort of where we are and what we're doing. So you got to take a look. Great interview with Chris Osborne. He's a, you know, well-read, experienced guy, and I always enjoy talking to him.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.